Good evening.
Good evening.
All of the world religions that I've heard about, the major traditional religions and some less known religions, they all encourage the followers to adhere to certain rules. And we know these as precepts or commandments and various rules that people are to follow. And I think this all came about in each of those religions very early, when the founders and the elders understood that the minds of their followers and the minds of people everywhere, actually, their minds are very unruly. People's minds are unruly. So they established rules. What do you do when people's minds are unruly? You give them rules. So the founders, the elders, decided that people's minds need direction, because they want people's minds to, they want people to behave in their best interests, their personal best interest, and the best interest for their in their relationships. So, because of this, the religions and philosophies have various lists of what to do and what not to do. As if we are still children. As if we are still children and don't know how to make wise decisions. Followers of religions are handed precepts and commandments and rules, which is a signal that you don't know how to make good decisions. In our practice, we have a bit of a different viewpoint and a different attitude towards that. Zen practice does not discourage awareness and reflection of the precepts. And it's always, you know, in the background of our mind. It's always there. But we don't talk so much about precepts or commandments. And it's because talking about them can become very intellectual, an intellectual exercise or philosophical discussion. They can become intellectual and not felt. If you talk too much about precepts, they come here, and they don't come here. So we don't talk about them so much. If you talk about them too much, they don't become felt, and it runs the risk of developing into a very narrow belief system. Just these rules, narrow belief system. A narrow belief system, and even worse, sort of a militarization of values. And we've seen that happen in history. These are the rules, and you better. Militarization of values. On the other hand, our practice emphasizes the inherent bodhisattva quality of people. The bodhisattva qualities. And our practice emphasizes trust. trust that we, the followers, will be dedicated to discovering the truth through our own efforts and to live our lives accordingly, through our own discoveries. This is a major feature of our practice. So Zen emphasizes encouragement to practice and to train our minds to see beyond delusion and to see beyond childish things. Zen relies on trust, not on admonishment. So these precepts or these commandments, they create a picture of what is supposed to be our moral and ethical behavior. And when we read the precepts, study them a little bit, they seem pretty clear. We think we know what they mean. The words are not ambiguous. We think we know what they mean, and we think we know what they include. But the actual meaning of the precepts is beyond their literal interpretation. Because it means we keep the precepts while we are breaking the precepts. Not on purpose, not by design, not by intention, but it's just the way the world is. We keep the precepts while we are breaking the precepts. It is impossible not to break precepts and our mental habits. It's impossible not to break them. So, for example, we hear in our practice, you're not supposed to discriminate. Don't discriminate amongst things. Don't judge. But as we know, if we are to make useful and helpful decisions in our everyday life, we must pick and choose. We must discriminate. We must make choices, and we must judge what's good, what's useful, and what's harmful. We have to do that. All the while we hear a voice saying, "Oh, don't discriminate." And we also say, "Don't kill." First precept is don't kill, don't take life. But we don't criticize the Eskimo when he has to kill a seal to feed himself and his family. And we don't criticize each other when we take a vegetable from the ground for our meal. So we have to break the precepts. Strictly speaking, we are always violating the precepts in order to support life. So the hunter-gatherers in Africa, they hunt down animals, beautiful animals, and kill them for their meat. How foolish would it be to lecture them about don't kill? So sometimes we have to break the precepts. And we also say you shouldn't have any desires, and you shouldn't have any expectations. Yet we have come to practice with a desire. A desire to change some circumstances of our life. But fundamentally, we come with what Suzuki Roshi called our innermost desire. So we start practice in violation of one of the precepts, you know, don't desire. We're looking for something for ourselves to help us. And we continue to violate precepts when we have these kinds of desires. So sometimes our desire is personal, it's for self-oriented, for ourselves, to help us feel better, to help us get understanding, maybe to gain some fame and attention, or maybe it's to relieve stress. We come to practice. Sometimes we even have the desire to be free of desire. But sometimes our desire is selfless. We want to live creatively. We want to live with care, and we want to help others. We want to respond to our life situation without confusion. So strictly speaking, these are desires, and they violate the precepts literally. On the other hand, they do not violate the spirit of the precepts. And so then we are allowed, you know, we are allowed to have that desire that does not break the spirit of the precepts. Desires are okay if they are for the purpose of benefiting others. So we can't really avoid violating precepts in daily life. But we don't worry about that so much. What we emphasize instead is carrying the spirit of the precepts with us. And then our practice becomes pure in its impurity. And then there is no violation. So there's some kind of thinking, the thinking we might have when we are beginning, that if I do this practice unconditionally, I can become perfect in all the things that I do. I will perfect all my activities. I won't make mistakes anymore. This practice will really show me how to be. But if we become attached to the idea of being perfect, that's a violation of the precepts. If we attach to some idea that we will be 100% free of having discrimination, this is a violation of the precepts, if we attach to that idea. But if we have no idea of achieving 100% of this or something, 100% of that, if we have no idea of achievement, the mind will become gentle and flexible. And then it will be capable of keeping the spirit of the precepts, and then there is no violation. Our practice begins with Zazen, where we learn to express our selflessness. And so we think that Zazen is kind of pure, untainted, a perfect activity. But Zazen is not a pure or perfect activity. because it is beyond any label. If you say Zazen is the purest of activities, it's the most perfect activity we can do, oh, you're already violating the precepts. Because Zazen is beyond any label. In Zazen, you know, all the activities of our life are present. They are continuing while we sit quietly with an empty mind. All the activities of our life are engaged. All activities are included in Zazen. It is, we call it the universal activity. So no need to describe it as good or even perfect. And included in Zazen are all the activities, including the activity of a wandering mind. That comes, that's part of life. It's included in Zazen. So if we notice when we sit that our mind has wandered, it's not, you know, bad, not a bad thing. And no need to think that, my practice is not okay. The point is we try to keep the spirit of the practice, no matter what comes up. So if there is wandering mind, we simply return. Return to the center. We come back to the present when the mind wanders. So the point of our practice is not to be concerned with good or bad. If we promise to do good, that may feel good. But it can also lead to feeling self-righteous. I'm doing good. It's what is known as a spiritual sickness. And promising to do good can lead to an attitude that says, look at me, I'm a spiritual person. So if we do something that's helpful, we should be quiet about it. If we do something that's helpful and we proclaim it, broadcast it, that's a violation. So we always keep the spirit of the precepts, no matter what activity we do. In other words, the point of our practice is to continue Buddha's spirit, or Suzuki Roshi's spirit. I'm sorry you never got to meet him. If you met him, you'd want to. You know what I mean. Oh, let's continue his spirit. So the point of our practice is to continue Buddha's spirit, to have an empty and a ready mind. That is, empty of ideas about practice. So practice means not to hold on to anything in our mind, even ideas about doing good. So to keep the practice, to keep the spirit of practice in our everyday life, we are all always ready to do something helpful and to do our best to respond to life naturally. Sometimes we're faced with a situation where there seems to be many choices and we don't know what to do. We don't know what is the most helpful. In cases like that, we wait. We don't decide until we can sort through all the confusion and do our best to come up with the one thing that will be helpful. We want to be able to respond to situations spontaneously without preconceived ideas. Sometimes we have to be patient when the answer doesn't appear spontaneously. We have to be patient and watch. But with our continued practice and having had various experiences in our life, we will learn how to respond to life situations. So maybe we come to practice with a desire, which we're not supposed to have, but maybe we come to practice with a desire to be a better person, or to do good things. But if that desire, if the attitude that we have with that desire is selfless, then it loses the quality of being a desire. The quality of that desire becomes the quality of trust. So we go from desire to be a good person to trusting that we are and will be a good person. So we trust our practice and we trust our ready mind. This is how we keep the precepts. Even if sometimes we have to violate the precepts. If we have this kind of spirit, if we have this kind of understanding, then this very mixed up world that we live in will be no problem. Because the entire world is enlightenment and the entire world is delusion at the same time. Happiness and suffering are included in the entire world. So we take care of enlightenment and desires. We take care of happiness and suffering with the spirit of practice. And that's where we find our freedom, and that's how we feel our desires. I was struck by something I read today about the Nobel Prize that was recently awarded to an economist. I think his name is Thayer. Thayer. Is that?
I think it was Thaler.
Thaler. Peter Thaler? Anyway. Richard Thaler. Okay, thank you. So he was an economist that worked on the old The previous theory of economics was that human beings will make financial decisions, economic decisions, rationally, because human beings are a rational creature. And when they have when they have choices, they will rationally make the best financial decision or economic decision. So in more recent years, some economists have said, hold it. People aren't rational. Where did you get that idea? So this economist did a lot of work taking this more recent approach that says human beings make decisions irrationally, not always rational. And he did some work that has led to some very useful things, and he won the Nobel Prize. And I thought, isn't this what Buddha said 2,300 years ago? Watch out for desires. It gets in the way of your thinking. It gets in the way of your decision making. Your desires will bring you suffering. Watch out for your desires. So this economist won the Nobel Prize because he's saying these irrational desires get in the way of human beings making these decisions. So it's now an industry, you know, what Buddha said. Watch out for your desires. Now they have models and studies and Nobel Prizes investigating that truth at a very intellectual level. And it struck me as humorous that we now have to have studies and computer models to confirm what Buddha said. Anyway, that happened. That thought occurred to me today. To understand the spirit of our practice, we have to commit our life to continuous practice in all activities. It doesn't mean that we have to leave our everyday life like traditional monks and nuns go to a monastery. We can commit our life to continuous practice just where we are. All our activities. And that's, of course, what we're trying to learn how to do. And as we learn and as we try, little by little, our mind becomes calmer and less childish, less swayed by desire. We make better decisions. And life becomes very large. Does anyone have a question tonight?
So, Les, I suppose that one could ask if the right attitude toward the precepts is not to get to the point of living your life so that you're in constant agreement with the precepts, always following the precepts, then what are they for? What good are they? And that question reminds me of something that I heard someone say, a similar thing, about the Eightfold Path. You know, if you're not supposed to have a gaining idea, a path is something that gets you from where you are to somewhere that you want to go, to get to some destination, and that sounds like a gaining idea. So what good is the Eightfold Path? And the person who was talking said, you shouldn't think of the Eightfold Path, the Bodhisattva path, as a way to get from where you are to some distant goal in the future where you want to be. He said, it's a way to see how you should put one foot in front of the other moment after moment. That's what the path is for. And I wonder if perhaps the precepts aren't like that too. Is it right to say that we don't have a gaining idea that we want to somehow arrive at perfect adherence to the precepts, but that the precepts inform our choices in every moment, send us in a direction rather than trying to reach some perfection goal? Is that the right attitude?
I've heard the precepts referred to not like as if they were commandments, but more like the 10 suggestions. And it's up to you to do something with these suggestions. Each of us. It's up to each of us to decide what to do with these suggestions. Thank you.
Colleen?
I'm struck by the line at the end of the Metta Sutta, the loving kindness meditation, and it talks about how to live your life. And then it ends with, and then if you're living like that, there's no separation between life and death. And there's peace if you follow the precepts, or if you take the suggestions of the Eightfold Path. You know, you have been given not only the gift of it's the gift of peace. It's the gift of peace. You don't have anything more. You don't have anything to worry about.
We don't have anything to worry about. When?
If you're living. If you're living, and maybe you don't even need the precepts or the Eightfold Path, but if you're living a quiet, selfless life where you don't harm, everything's going to be okay. There's no problem. There's no problem. I was sort of wondering, and that's why I suggested that we do that series on the Eightfold Path. You know, we it seems like we all get caught up on. We get stuck on the third noble truth. You know, the cause of suffering is desire, and then we forget about. And then, okay, here are some suggestions, and it might be a really good idea to really study those suggestions. I mean, these things, the Buddha was brilliant, and. Not such a bad idea to look at the suggestions.
Do you look at them?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do, and I find them really helpful.
Okay.
And I look at the precepts, and I do go over in my mind, you know, the top Buddhist five: no killing, no stealing, no lying, faithfulness in relationships, no intoxication. Yeah, I sometimes ask myself, how am I doing with these things? And then the grave precepts, you know, wow, am I living up to these things, you know? Am I holding grudges? Am I getting angry? Am I holding myself higher than others? Am I being possessive? These are good questions to be asking oneself. Very good questions. I think they're brilliant. I think that's really, there's a reason why these things have come down, because there's a real wisdom in them, and a guide for human relationships and how to live in community. I think that's why the reason behind Buddha setting up these rules is because people lived in community and how to help people get along. And, you know, you were saying that there's, if you have a good spirit and also the beginner's mind, that's basically all you need. And that is the transmission, that's the transmission from Buddha and all down the line. I was reading in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that all of this mind, it's this mind and this spirit that is transmitted. And you're right, it doesn't have to all be laid out. If you have the right spirit, you're gonna be fine. And I think in Zen Beginner's Mind, that I think Suzuki Roshi made the same point that you did, that you don't have to be paying attention to the point that you made.
It's an interesting point to consider. You know, we've heard about the golden rule. We should treat others like we would want to be treated. Or to put it very, very simply, just be nice. Seems to me the precepts are saying, if you don't know what that means, let me spell it out for you. Be nice. Somewhere along the line, the founders and the elders said, they don't understand what it means to be nice. They are having trouble with it. We better give them a list of rules. Zen practice is saying, fundamentally, you don't need a list. Maybe initially you do. But fundamentally, inherently, you don't need a list. You know, you've met people in your life, I'm sure, who seem to have gotten it without any effort. They just so friendly and kind and so generous, and they've always been that way, without any kind of practice or study or training or anything, just... But most of us, you know, we stumble, and we need some guidance. But fundamentally, we don't. So our practice appeals to that part of us that doesn't need the list.
that knows what it means to be nice and generous without any explanation. So it is an interesting point. You know, some religions say you'll never be able to do it on. You'll never be able to do it on your own. You need to rely on somebody here to help you to do it for you. Zen at least says you have to do it. And our practice is you can do it. We can do it because it's inherent. So how far we go with precepts and commandments, how far we include them in our practice, this is an interesting point. If we go too much, we lose the spirit. If we don't do at least something, maybe people will be confused. So it's tricky. Thank you. Yes, please.
This topic kind of always bothered me a little, so I have a thought and a question about it. So the thought is that it seems to me that there is a big difference between aiming in some direction and aiming towards some spot. So, for instance, it seems to me that it's clearly a good thing to aim to act as a good person would act. But it's always counterproductive to wonder whether you are kind of a good enough person to label yourself as a good person. And it's counterproductive no matter what your answer is. It's that if you think that you're not good enough yet, then you're afraid you'll never get there. And if you think you're good enough, then you're afraid that one day you won't be. And it seems like maybe it's the same way with the precepts, that it's kind of counterproductive to think about whether you have achieved the point where you are not harming living beings enough, but it's always good to kind of aim to not harm living beings. So that was the thought. And the question, I don't know, it might not make much sense, but it's another thing that keeps bothering me a little, is that we chant that beings are numberless and I want to save them. And in the very structure of the sentence, like, it's made to make you think that you'll never actually save all the numberless beings. So the only way I know how to, well, at least a way I know how to interpret that is to say, well, I aim to save all beings. And I wonder, is that the same thing? Is there a difference? Does this matter? Like, why do we say I vow rather than I aim? This might not make any sense.
Oh, a vow is a promise.
But the thing is that the way you say it, like, you will never get there because the beings are numberless.
Get where?
Well, so what we chant is that beings are numberless and I vow to save them.
Yes.
So, at least I feel like I can't seriously promise that I will save them all, because I just said they're numberless. I'll never get them. Mm-hmm. So the only way I can kind of, I think that has a lot to do with the precept, like I can feel like I will aim to save them. But I always feel a little bit uncomfortable saying I vow to save them. And should I don't know, does this difference matter? Should I just think that this is the direction I'm aiming?
Well, you have to understand the meaning of all sentient beings. The one who is in front of you at any moment is all sentient beings. So if you can be nice to that person at that moment, You are fulfilling your vow. So if we, you know, if we take these things too literally, it can be very confusing. So we have to say, what does it really mean behind all these words? So, best to do is sort of relax. Not take them too literally. But, you know, let's be nice. Thank you. Yes, Anna?
I think this goes to what you were saying a little bit earlier and to relate to what Carolina was saying. I find it a helpful exercise sometimes if I'm having a trouble or an issue to go over the path and the vows as kind of a checklist, especially if it's complex, to think what might be the trouble. Was I careless with my speech? Or am I holding myself above others? Or am I being judgmental? What was I missing? Is it a good way to problem solve when things are complex? But I find that when I do that, and if it becomes a regular habit instead of in certain situations, then I'm living in the past or in the future, because I'm saying that in the future I'm going to do right, or I'm going over every past situation and going over that difficult checklist. So it's difficult to let go and trust yourself that you are just good enough, and you'll know without that list. And also balance so much information that we have every day to know that you'll do the least harmful thing, and know that for everything involved in our situations every day. And I wonder what kind of spring cleaning we could do of our practice to keep it pure, so that we don't have to worry about that list.
Spring cleaning. We sit every morning very early. This is our cleaning. But there was a Suzuki Roshi lecture in Zen Mind, and he says it's necessary sometimes have a general house cleaning of our mind. You know, it's a good metaphor. We should stop and say, how am I doing? If you're sincere in your practice, there's no problem. Thank you. Yes, please.
So, can you know the value of precepts or commandments unless you break them? And I guess my point is, when we talk about not having desires or having desires, it's a dualistic way of thinking, because everybody has desires. And that's part of it. I have desires. And I don't try to rid myself of my desires, because I think that, I've made some huge whopping mistakes in my life because of bad desires, but I've learned a lot about myself and the world by doing this, and I don't regret them at all. And I don't look forward to not having desires. I look forward to making some more whopping mistakes. So I guess my question is, can you really know the value of any precept unless you break it?
That's a really good point. How we gain wisdom when we make a decision and it turns out to be not such a good one, and we learn about our way of thinking and our desires and our biases that went into that decision. And we see if it turns out poorly, we learn from that. So you're right, we have to make mistakes. It seems like we have to make mistakes and gain the experience. that comes from it, and in order to gain the intuition to know how to respond when things turn up. And it's, people call it, you know, it's known as maturing or growth or development or something like that. It's not possible to go through life without making mistakes. Not possible. So we try to keep aware of it, keep our awareness on it and learn from it, like you say. So I think you're right. The value of a precept comes from the result of not following it when it turns out badly. And we know, oh, I see why they told me that. Yeah. So it's a good point, thank you. Yes, Dave.
That's all this discussion about it's not realistic to take literally the four bodhisattva vows because they vow to do something that can't literally be done, or we don't see the Eightfold Path as being something where we're going to get to the end of it and arrive at some destination. And similarly, we're not going to get to the point of literally being totally always observant of all of the precepts. There was an analogy that just popped into my head that, for me, sheds a little light on this. We sometimes, as a sort of shorthand, refer to moral ideals like the precepts or the Ten Commandments. We sometimes refer to those as somebody's moral compass. Moral compass. And you know, what is a compass, right? It's something that helps you find your way. So when you're lost in the tangled woods, you can pull out your compass and say, oh, here's a device that points to the North Pole, and that's where I'm trying to go. But that's not really what the compass is for. What the compass is for is to help you put one foot in front of the other in the tangled woods, step by step. It's not about getting to the North Pole, even though that's where the compass seems to point. Just a thought.